stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today, I'm playing an interview I did with singer, actor, and currently director, Melisse Kenworthy. Melisse's story is interesting partly because she was drawn to an art as a very young girl, which most young girls of her age are not drawn to. So, are you curious? Good. Hang on. Here come the show. Show is all about self-discovery. Now, for some people, this may seem an odd thing to try and do, to discover a self with whom I have lived all of my life. How could I not know the self that I am? But as a psychotherapist who's been in practice for more than 30 years, I have seen over and over again that we human beings don't always know who we are. In fact, sometimes we are the last to know who we are. In fact, sometimes everyone else knows more about us than we do. How can this be? Well, if you've been listening to the show, you've heard me say this over and over and over and over again, but I will continue to say it over and over again because it's not an easily accepted fact for most of us. I believe that in order to survive the family into which we have been born, and this doesn't mean dysfunctional or abusive families, all families, in my experience, have an idea about the way their children should be. There are roles which need to be played, and these roles are not determined by your parents, they're determined by the parents they had and the ones before them and the ones before them. These ideas about the good and bad, the right and wrong, the appropriate and inappropriate, these things get passed down from generations, and they're not conscious. They're reflexive. They're unconscious. They're intuitive. This is right. This is wrong. This is good. This is bad. This is, I'm not sure. Now, obviously, some families are more flexible than others. Some parents have more tolerance than others. But mostly, all parents have some ideas. And they're not the same across the board. I know a parent who had been raised by a family that did not really allow her to express herself. She felt stifled and shy about her opinions and unable to really be assertive about what she wanted or needed or thought, for that matter. So obviously this is someone who was able to deny an ability to be forthcoming. Well, she had a little boy, and this little boy began quite young to demonstrate a very powerful sense of himself, which of course she had too, because pretty much all children do. She was enamored of this behavior in this little boy. She thought this was terrific. This was a little boy who was not going to buckle, not going to be shy, So she encouraged that behavior in that child, not realizing that at the very same time, she was discouraging the ability to be quiet, the ability to wait and see, the ability to let others participate, to share. She encouraged a kind of assertiveness, an extreme, really, at the same time discouraging a kind of thoughtfulness, comfort with quiet. So this mother was in denial for, unable to access her ability to be assertive, and her son in denial for, unable to access his ability to lay back and let others lead. Now, both of these qualities are important. The ability to be forthcoming, to say, this is what I want, this is what I need, this is what I think, to participate in the social intercourse so that your thoughts are made known, so that what you need can be manifest. They're very important, obviously. But the other side is also important. The ability to let another lead, to be open to other opinions, to rest, for God's sakes, to be quiet, to be thoughtful. This is also very important. So what we had here was a mother who didn't have the one and the son who didn't have the other. And this is through no fault of anybody's. This is what felt right. This is what felt natural. This is what felt appropriate. Okay, so in my view, to some extent, this is happening to all of us. Something about us is being encouraged, and something about us is being discouraged. And the thing that is being discouraged, I label as going undercover. And the things about us which were encouraged, I label as being a part of our cover story. Much like a spy, we have what we present as is true of us. Now, of course, with a spy, they're hiding things about themselves, their nationality, their political position, and I don't know what else a spy might be hiding. But a spy is hiding these things in order not to be in danger, not to be discovered as who they really are. And I think we're doing the same thing. We are hiding those aspects of ourselves because the danger is that it will not be appreciated, approved of, loved, tolerated even, or it might be punished by our family of origin, or our peers, or the culture in which we live. And this is not tolerant, not tolerable, certainly not from our family of origin. If our family of origin doesn't like us, we know perfectly well that that is a dangerous thing. So the difference between us and the spy is that the spy knows what it's hiding. And when it is in a safe place, it can be, well, he or she can be him or herself. We are not so fortunate. We manage to hide these qualities so well that we have forgotten that we have them. The mother in this case, quite unable to say, no, I don't like that, don't do that, or this is what I want. And her speech patterns continually had sentences like, I don't care, whatever you want, that's okay. Anything's okay with me. And of course, her son didn't have those sentences, phrases, idioms in his vocabulary. He had the more directive, more insistent, more demanding language. Now, why is this important? Well, I think it's self-evident, but I'll say it anyway, even though, as I said, I think it's self-evident and I have said it many times. It's unfortunate and ironic, but quite often it is precisely the quality which we have had to deny, which is the one that we need later in life in order to live a full and satisfying life, even to live the life we were meant to live, the life that is instinctive to us. And so, of course, a lot of people wind up in therapy looking for the very thing they have denied. You know that old idiom about, you know, you can find what you've been searching for right in your own backyard? Well, that turns out to be the truth a lot of the time in therapy. People come into therapy wanting to do something they don't think they can do, or wanting to stop something that they think they can't stop. And quite often the capacity, the ability, is there inside them, deeply hidden under cover. And the work is to first help the person become aware of it, to recognize that it was always there and simply needs to be accessed. And I'm sorry I used the word simply, because of course it is not simple. There are big obstacles to accessing what we have denied. We denied it for a very good reason, because there was a danger attached to knowing it and using it. And we still believe in that danger, even if the danger is not accurate, isn't true. We still believe in it. So somebody deep inside of us is resisting it. And quite often the danger is still there. Not in the way it was for us as a child, but still. There is a price. And that reminds me that I wrote a book about this called When You Can, You Will, Why You Can't Always Do What You Want to Do and What to Do About It. And what reminded me about it is that there's a chapter in the book called The Price and the Payoff. So this might be a good time to say that you could find the book. You can find pretty much anything you might want to know about me on my website, thelynnshow.com, T-H-E-L-Y-N-N-E, don't leave the E out of Lynn, S-H-O-W, thelynnshow.com. You can find the book, you can find an article on therapy on the phone called Therapy on the Go, which is how I do all my therapy these days. And if you want to talk to me, there's a space for email me and ask me any questions you want about what it's like to do therapy on the phone, questions about change. And you can hear the podcasts of all the shows I've ever done, which include all the interviews I have ever done, including the interview that I'm about to play today. I interview people who make their living or their life with an art. You will hear me explain that to Melissa Kenworthy, who is the interview I'm playing today, as I explain to everyone I'm interviewing. I interview people who make their living or their life with an art, because in order to do that in this culture, it has to be who you really are. We don't make it easy for artists to survive in this culture. If you are an artist, any kind of artist, or you know or love an artist, any kind of artist, you know that this culture is very, very hard on them. We don't support them. We call what they do playing, and in that way we discount them. Of course, we pay huge amounts of money for the few that we decide, for whatever reason, we should be paying them the money, but the rest of them are mostly struggling. And so, when one chooses to give a living, to make a living, or to give their life, and lots of artists, all kinds, of course, make a life with their art, but they don't make a living with it. You know, so when a person has chosen to do that, to give large chunks of their life to painting, to dancing, to singing, or in Melissa's case, as in Melissa's case, to singing, to acting, to directing, it is because who they really are. And when you hear them talk about their life and their commitment to their work, then you can hear what it sounds like to be who you really are, to be living the life you were meant to live. And of course, I play these interviews in the hope that it will be inspiring to everyone who hears it to ask the question, is there a way in which I am denying something essential about myself? Am I living the life that I was meant to live? Well, today you can hear what that sounds like from Melissa Kenworthy. So here she is. I am here with Melissa Kenworthy in my kitchen because she was kind enough to come here and do this with me. And I'm going to explain to Melissa. I interview people who make their living or their life with an art.
Nice.
And clearly that is true for you. Mm-hmm. And the art to which you have given your life, as I understand it, would be basically theater?
Yes.
Act, sing, dance?
Acting, singing, yes.
Yeah.
Now it's directing.
And now directing.
I call it my second act.
Not bad. Okay, so really I only ask one question, and that is, how did you discover it? What was the very first moment in your life, if you can remember, when it occurred to you that being on stage, making people look at you, stories, dancing, you know, was something compelling to you, something interesting? Can you?
I would say third grade in Philadelphia, when the class was asked to sing for the parents.
Huh?
All the rest of the kids were scared to death. I stepped up with the group and I sang and I loved it. It was an Italian song, I can't think of it now, very well known. And my mother and aunt came and they said, is that our Melissa? She's louder than all the rest of the kids. I didn't know she could sing because I never liked pop music. I never sang around the house. It just didn't touch me. But I liked doing that.
Well, wait a minute. How did you find this Italian song?
The class was given it. We were taught to sing it.
Oh, yes. So everybody...
They were all singing it. They were all a nervous wreck singing it, and I was louder than what, however many were in the class, 30, whatever. And that was the beginning, and I went, oh, I really like this.
Okay, and, so you discovered how much you liked doing
singing.
That.
Yes.
And your mother and aunt discovered that you actually could.
Yes.
So what happened after that?
Well, at least I was louder. And then I guess there was a time that passed, and at the age of 10, I discovered Milton Cross and his Saturday afternoon Metropolitan Opera performances.
Yeah.
I was playing dress-ups in the basement of our house in Pleasantville, New Jersey. And I would, it was able to go la 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 with the music. And I discovered I loved it. I loved it. It was so exciting. And of course, it was something being sung in Italian that day, most likely. And I went and asked my mother what it was. And she came to the steps. She listened. She said, I think it's opera. So the following Monday, I was at the library and I got Milton Cross's book of the great operas. And I started poring over them. And around that time, or maybe a little bit later, The Great Caruso came out, and living in Philadelphia, Mary Alonzo was our god, you know. And my aunt, the one who had heard me sing in third grade, she had bought me all his albums and records, and I started to sing along with him.
Okay, hold on. This is quite odd. Well, of course, it's quite odd for a young girl,
10 to 12 years old,
right, who's not particularly getting this from her family,
no.
To be drawn to this music, don't you think?
Yes, I was always odd.
Ah.
My parents never got beyond Lawrence Welk. They loved that. No, but bless their hearts, they supported me and they trotted out to my concerts. And
Well, wait.
That came later.
Yeah, no kidding. All right. But I'm absolutely fascinated. Your aunt got you the Mario Lanza record.
Everything he recorded.
Is this because they saw that you had this interest?
No, I asked for it and I was excited about it. Yes. And
you went to the library and you got Milton Cross's book and
yes.
You went in. And so when you went through, I'm absolutely fascinated by this.
And loved opera from that day on.
Right. So when you went through the book, I don't know, was it just the librettos?
It's just the librettos, yeah. And in my childish handwriting, I would write about it because I was getting records now and listening, and because they weren't all on the Saturday afternoon broadcast, and no one took me to the opera at that young age.
Right.
So this is how I was just fascinated by it.
Okay, so this clearly, it spoke to you. That's the point, right?
It really
spoke to you. Okay, so now we have this passion developing, this interest, this compulsion, really. I mean, because it is pretty compelling to make you go and do all these things and get all these things. On your own, exactly, with no discouragement, but no real encouragement. Nobody's saying, wow, oh yeah, we got an opera singer.
And that time, Voice of Firestone and Bell Telephone Hour was big on television. I waited for that Monday nights, I remember one was on, and I would get to sing along with that, you know.
So you would sing along in the house with your family?
With my music, yes. Mm-hmm.
Right. Okay, so did you get lessons? I mean, did they have the sense to do something?
Then at ninth grade in Philadelphia, you went to high school. And I had this marvelous teacher, Frances L. Snyder, long dead now, bless her heart, who encouraged me and talked to me. I immediately joined the choir there, of course. And she said, now, you're too young to start lessons. People start too young for the voice. Never start before 15 and 16. Start piano. Start your foundation, which a musical instrument and piano is very important. But sing in the choir, sing in church choirs or wherever if you have an opportunity. But
this was the choir teacher?
In Philadelphia at Abraham Lincoln High School. And so I did everything she said. She was my mentor, and it was fine, and I loved the choral singing, and I got solos.
I'm sure you did.
Before I even started lessons, and I found a wonderful teacher at the age of 15, a tenor, who didn't push me.
And, well, wait a minute, so you're studying piano now?
Yes.
Right, okay. And your family says, okay, fine, we'll get you piano lessons,
yep.
Right?
My mother went to work to buy me a piano.
Wow.
They were supportive.
Right. Wow.
But my first voice teacher was perfect. He said, we're not going to classify your voice, which is good. We're going to do mid-range art songs and sing things like hymns and choral pieces, but don't push it either way. Let the voice decide where you're going to go. And that's such good advice.
Oh, my God. And so amazing.
Because sometimes they start too young. And if there's a need at that particular time, because like everything else, it's cyclical, all of a sudden we need more mezzos or we need more basses and all. And sometimes they try to push the voices. Not good.
No.
Not good. No. So that's how I started. And I sang at any opportunities. And then I started to get in my teens, because I needed to make some money to pay for my lessons, I started to sing in churches.
And I'm just curious, you went to a church and said, I'd like to audition
no,
for
no,
you.
No, they opened, there were advertisements.
There were.
And within the in music circle, you knew where people
were hiring.
Wanting to hire a quartet or soloists. Yes, it still goes on like that. And around the age of 18, I got to sing in a synagogue in Philadelphia. The whole quartet were Gentiles. They taught us all the music by rote. They paid better than any church ever paid, and to this day I'm very comfortable to go into. Oh, I remember that. Yeah, but it was a wonderful experience because, well, we were sight reading and we were learning another language. And then there were opportunities to sing at bar mitzvah, bat mitzvahs, and receptions, and it was great. And so I have always appreciated, I'm sorry, it was Temple Emmanuel. And I always appreciated what they did for me. So I got to do, I did all of that because this...
Well, I just want to say, they did it, but you chose it. Not everybody would have done that. Not everybody would it have been lovely to learn another language. I mean, you know.
Oh, well, you have to be learning languages if you're studying voice seriously. You have to learn Italian and French and
yes,
German and Russian.
But there aren't that many operas in Hebrew.
No. No, that's true. But you know, once you get the hang of it, it's really lovely to sing in. Certain languages I found was, for my voice, from just my voice and its placement, it really lent itself. And you got going. Mm-hmm. It was fine.
All right, good. So then?
Well, it ended up that the University of Pennsylvania in the late 50s was looking to have more women go. And they started to reach out in the community. It wasn't all what it had been in the past, where you had to have a lot of money and be male. And I was able to get a scholarship to the University of Pennsylvania to be a history major. I liked history. I couldn't go to college without a scholarship because my family did not.
And they weren't going to give it to you in music?
No. They're not known for their music program, and no, that wasn't available. But down deep, I knew I really, really, really wanted to study music, and I really wanted a career in music. But I took what was offered and was very, very grateful.
Mm-hmm.
So I was a day student in Philadelphia. I didn't live on campus and I didn't have the money to really involve myself the way I'd like to in the life at an Ivy League school. I loved history, by the way, still do. And that was fine. But what was offered? In those days, you would have had to go on a course for your master's to be a librarian or a teacher. If history or whatever. And I wasn't going to.
No.
So all the time that I'm down there at the in the campus and working, riding the Philadelphia L back and forth, spending a great deal of time commuting, which was good because I was able to do a lot of homework, I still was taking voice lessons. And by that time I had moved on to a lovely woman, a soprano, and she was really gave me wonderful advice. I was quite hurt at the time. But she gave me good advice. And then I'm getting ahead of myself because a lot of this was overlapping, I might say, at the time. Knowing that history was not going to be my career at Penn and not feeling I fit in, I checked on the Philadelphia Conservatory of Music, which has now merged with the Philadelphia Academy of Vocal Arts. And I also took a few outside lessons at Curtis. I thought, well, maybe I should go to Philadelphia Conservatory of Music because I really wanted to sing in opera. Well, to do that, I'd have to drop my scholarship at Penn.
Mm.
So I had 3 years at Penn, and I did not graduate there, which was turned out of my life was fine because I never went anywhere where I needed that.
It was really brave.
Yeah, but it was tough doing that. And part of the reason was I had won the Young People's Concerts with the Philadelphia Orchestra at the age of 18 to sing under Eugene Ormandy.
Mm.
So I was feeling quite full of myself, you know, and that this was going to be it, this was going to be it. And through all this, I didn't really have any good mentoring and counseling.
Yeah, right.
I often lament that because my wonderful teacher in high school, she let me go on my way and she had her other things and I never had another one. And I was scattered. I have to admit, I was scattered.
Well, there was really no way you could know what
was
you
right.
should have done,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
I mean, how could you?
And remember, I was a woman in the late 50s.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, it was a different world.
Yes.
So I transferred to Philip Conservatory of Music, and of course I was basically putting myself through it, but I had all these extra jobs. I was working all the time. And I got hired by the Philadelphia Opera Company, Grand Opera, which is also now defunct. It was a long time ago. And I sang in the chorus and did some compromaria roles.
Well, that must have been very exciting. You were pretty young.
Yeah, 18, 19, 20.
Right.
And it was very exciting. It was very hitty. But this teacher, I have to get back to Catherine. Catherine Parr, her name was, by the way. The famous last wife of Henry VIII. She said, Melissa, she said, you have a lovely voice and you have very good stage presence. She says, you're very natural and you're pretty, nice figure. She says, but you're lacking that strong ambition. She says, I don't feel that you taste it. It's your whole fiber is screaming out that I have to do this. And she said, sopranos, your lyric spinto probably. It was still, you know, absolutely positive. She said, and they're a dime a dozen. And she was right. She was right. She says, the competition is just unbelievably tough. She said, I think you should consider operetta. It was the very last 8 days of operetta by then, because it had really peaked in the Second World War, maybe the beginning of the 50s, and it was on its way out. She says, but you would be very good in the better musicals where they require big, trained voices. Mm-hmm. Well, I was quite taken back by that, you know. I mean, I had gone to them and enjoyed it, but that wasn't what I wanted to do. But you know what? I took time and I listened to that woman. She gave me the best advice anyone had given me.
Right.
Because that's where I ended up and that's where I belonged.
Wow.
So, let's see, what did I do after that? So, it took me, by the way, I graduated in 61 and then I left Philadelphia. But I did not actually start theater until I was 30.
Wow.
In Indianapolis, there's this little hiatus of 9 years, I guess. I decided, this is why I say I was not focused, so I wasted a lot of energy and time. I'm so sorry as I look back. I wanted to get away from home. It was not the best home. And I wanted to do it properly. I was always worried about being proper. Again, that's the end of that era, you know,
people
don't nowadays. So I, ready for this, became a United Airlines stewardess.
Okay.
I did. Because it was a good job for that time. It was legitimate.
Right.
It got me away from home. It was a reason. Because I didn't really know what to do with my voice. And I got hired immediately. And I was sent off to school in Chicago, where my aunt and uncle lived, the one that was always pushing me. If she had lived near me, she would have more or less been a mentor, I think. But we were always a distance. So I would stay with them. And I did that for a short period of time. I also was asked to train attendants, because I really liked doing it. I liked people, and the travel was fun, and blah, blah, blah. Well, I met my first husband. And so in those days when you got married, you had to go off the line. I later found out lots and lots of the flight attendants were married. They just had another phone for the dispatcher to call. The husband never answered it. But I did what I was told. Silly me in those days. So dutiful. And so I got married and I promptly had 2 children. And then my husband was with RCA at the time. We were sent to Buenos Aires.
Buenos Aires?
Yes, so I lived 2 years there. I'm giving you the 9 years.
Yeah, I got it.
There 2 years, and I got to go to the wonderful opera house in Buenos Aires. I heard Montserrat Caballé sing regularly there, and I sat in boxes next to the president at the time, because all the big companies down there were treated like royalties at that time. This was before everything changed. So I took advantage of it.
Yeah.
But I went down there without my music. We packed up everything and left it in storage in New Jersey. And I really missed it terribly those 2 years. And they had an English-speaking community theater down there, which I went to, but I never, ever thought of trying out. Never thought of it. So we come back. We were sent to Indianapolis, where RCA had a big, big division. And I expected to have gone back to Jersey. Find myself in the Midwest in Indianapolis. They didn't have jets in 1969 into there. Turned out I had the prettiest house of my life living there, Georgia, in 1924. And that's where I discovered theater, got my equity card, and my children loved it there. It was a wonderful 5 years in Indianapolis.
How did that happen?
Well, I was very, very bereft of my music and arts down in Argentina, that I wasn't into it. And so I looked in the paper. I got settled into the house, and there was this little ad for Footlight Musicals. They were doing a musical called Fanny, which I vaguely remembered from the early 50s with Lawrence Henderson. It had a minor success. So I looked at it, and I thought, well, maybe I'll just go out and try out for the chorus. So I dressed myself all up, because in those days you dress. And I dragged out, and this is my beloved from Kismet, walked down and sang, got the lead, and that was the beginning.
Wow.
That was in February of 70, and by May of 71, the following year, I had my equity card.
Wow.
Yes, and I argued with this stage manager, I can't join equity. I'm married with children, and this is costing $200 for dues. It's like $1,200 now. And I said, that's my daycare, and blah, blah, blah. And he told me, we later became friends, and he said to me, going to be a problem. Well, of course I wasn't.
No.
And I was singing with all these IU opera students, because the Indiana University in Bloomington, just south of Indianapolis, has a marvelous, well-thought-of opera program. And it was outdoors, so they wanted big voices. And I was older than the rest, as usual. That was the beginning of being older than everybody all the time. They were in their early 20s. I had just turned 30. And I was the only one married with children. And they hired 16 of us. Yes. Two in each of us. Yeah. And we sat down the first day of rehearsal and opened up our music. And the sound. And everybody was immediately in parts. And it was, I thought, I'm home. I have found my home. Well, I just loved it. And apparently, our first show we did was Hello Dolly, which is a fabulous chorus show and great music and very high. So I was told by the conductor, who had a lot to say, that he hadn't paid much attention to me in rehearsals, but he said, you walked out on that stage that first day. And I went, wow, he said, and I watched you the whole time. It was because I had really found my home.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
right. We had this beautiful live orchestra and this big stage. Oh, it was heaven. Mm-hmm. And
you had gone all the way back to that first day. That first day
when I stepped out with the
card,
right?
Uh-huh.
But it, boy, am I dense! It took me that long, because even in singing opera, I was in the chorus. Everything it was different. I was younger, and I, as I said, it wasn't terribly focused, but now...
Mm-hmm. Well, an opera is different
than what we're doing.
It is. Yeah. It's very different. And I don't think... I think that what you were taught, what you sort of allude to, you have alluded to several times, is the time really was different.
Yes.
And it really was tough for a woman to find a place in a business, in a work like that.
Oh, yeah. Anywhere, really.
Unless you had somebody who knew, and of course you never did, so it's amazing you found it when you did.
But my teacher hit on it. She said, you don't have the drive, the ambition, you don't taste it. You see, I was missing that.
Mm-hmm.
If I'd had it, I'd have found it before.
Yes, well, that's probably true. But so, given that you didn't have either, you didn't have that
very,
drive, that you didn't
hit. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
You think you did find it?
Yeah.
Okay, great. Okay, good. So
I took off with that. The following year they had me back. Of course, they started giving me parts.
Uh-huh.
Out of the course. And during the year I was working around Indianapolis, which now has so much more arts than it did then, but I did everything. So it's possible that I made up for a lot of lost time.
Yes.
Because I got to sing with the Indianapolis Symphony, too, and I was kept up my music lessons all the time. And I ran down to IU a few times to have a few master classes with this one woman who was particularly good with sopranos, and I found a very good teacher at Butler U there. So in the 5 years I was there, I just had a marvelous time. I got Variety Club awards, and I found a wonderful baritone partner. We were doing all sorts of stuff. Then my husband decided he wasn't happy there, and I was kind of wanting to go to Chicago. Mm-hmm. So off to Chicago we went, which was of course another world and much more competitive.
I was going to say the other irony or serendipity is that you found yourself in a place that was small enough, mm-hmm. so that you really could launch. Mm-hmm. That it might have been more difficult to launch in Chicago or New York.
Oh, very hard, because I just didn't have a resume to speak
of. That's right.
And I was able
right.
to...
You built
to,
it, in,
yes,
right?
In a very short amount of time.
Mm-hmm.
So in Chicago, I started to do commercials, so I got my SAG and AFTRA card there. And I got to do that too. And then I sang all over, and like women's clubs were very big, and they paid quite well. Mm-hmm. I did that. But remember, I had two children that I had to be around for too, because there were opportunities to travel, but it was tough. I did a little of it, and I always felt some guilt about that. But I got work there, and I also was able to take acting classes at the Goodman Theater, which is a Lord Theater like the Othello and mm-hmm. the Guthrie in Minneapolis. So I was scrambling to make up for lost time. And I got to do, in the 70s and 80s, I got to do a lot of fine musicals that I was very proud to be part of. I had a few roles that I got known for doing, and they would just call me and offer to me, and it was not always so good, because you get a little lazy and you don't stretch. So I did mostly musicals, though I always wanted to act. And I should have branched out and tried to do more of that. But eventually in the 80s, I did. So from, where am I now? I'm in Chicago. Well, then my husband had some setbacks, so we went back to Jersey. So I would go into New York City. We lived in Montclair, and I would go into New York City to audition, and everything that they offered was sending me out of town. So I did do that. The children were getting a little bit older, and so I would do that. I came close a couple times on Broadway. I would get called back and called back. One was for The Last King and I that Yul Brynner did. First they called me for Tupton, which was ridiculous. I was far too old to do it. But I had done it with Leonard Nimoy in Milwaukee. They saw that, so I did. I sang Tupton, very tall Tupton. And then I really wanted to do Lady Tiana. So they moved me into that. Well, ultimately, he had full say. He said that he wanted all Asian. Can't compete with that.
There's nothing to do about that.
Right. And the other one was Joanna Marilyn, a wonderful actress herself, who was one of the first daughters in Fiddler with Zero. She ended up being a casting director, and I regularly enjoy her performance on Law and Order. They have her as a judge frequently.
Mm-hmm.
And I got called out for, sent out by my agent for Mrs. Malloy, which is a role I had done a lot and really, really liked. With Carol Channing, One More Time was coming back. So I got called back about three times, and finally Joanna Mellon was so kind. She came down the edge of the stage. She says, unless you do a very lovely Mrs. Malloy, and I'm glad to have known you, and I'll keep you in mind. She says, but Carol, another one who has full say, has decided for her comfort she was going to use the last Mrs. Malloy. Well, why they ever had all these auditions, I don't know.
Right.
You know, why didn't they just keep the good people that they had instead of getting all our hopes up? So that's my sad tale. It's about as close as I ever got to Broadway.
Oh.
But I did some little parts on soaps, and that was fine. But it's tough in New York. It's tough. And by then, I was well into my late 30s and all, though I looked younger, but not that young. So I was in New York about 5-6 years, and I remarried, and my husband then took a job in Minneapolis. And so I ended up working out there. That's where I got a chance to do more non-musicals, which was good for my resume, and I liked it very much. And I found I liked doing comedy particularly.
Yeah. You're pretty funny.
Oh, yes, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
I felt I had watched the character people around me, well, I fed them as the straight lady.
Mm-hmm,
right. The knees together virgin, I always refer to as my roles that I was getting, the sweet, proper young lady. I would watch and think, they're blowing that. I could do better at that. You know, but I would never be considered. But then I finally got to the age where I could do that. And I love it. I love it, love it, love it, love it. So then I stayed there for 16 long years in Minneapolis, and I said to my husband, I had worked down in the Sarasota, Tampa area doing Sound of Music, which I had done about, when I finished 8 companies, I did Elsa, the other woman. I loved that role. And I worked at the Showboat Theater, which is also now defunct. Maybe it's my karma. And I loved the area. Gee, I was so impressed, especially with Sarasota. And I said to my husband, all right, you stuck me out here for 16 years. I pick where we go for retirement. He wanted to retire early. And I said, let's start vacationing so you could see. I said, they have arts. They have an opera company. They have a ballet company. They have a beautiful orchestra. So he came down. He was charmed with it. So this is where we ended up in 2000, 13 years now. So I figured, well, I was now 60. And then, I'll try, but who knows if I'll get anywhere. Well, I did.
Mm-hmm.
I did get work. And I've fallen into directing. I've never really sought it out, and I never really prepared a resume. I did directing up in Minneapolis, and I like it. Mm-hmm. I find it's very rewarding. It's very interesting work. And so that's what I'm doing, and I'm very happy to say that I'm directing for the Banyan Theater.
And let's talk about Painting Churches.
In 2003, I was hired by the Banyan, a new company here, to do Aunt Julie and Hedda Gabler. And then...
As a director? Or
no,
as
an actor. And then that same season, they had scheduled the wonderful Arthur Miller's The Price. And they lost their leading lady, the only woman in the show, suddenly left the company. And they turned to me to see if I would do it.
Mm-hmm.
And I, in my ignorance of what a wonderful part, but how difficult, said, okay.
Yeah, sure.
So I did it. And so that was as an actor.
Mm-hmm.
And then I didn't work there until 2011. They called me and offered me this part in Becky's New Car. And I went, oh, yeah, okay. But I never had talked to him about directing. And next thing I know, this year, now we're in 2013, he called and asked me if I would like to direct Painting Churches. And I had just finished doing the Vagina Monologues down in the Venice Little mm-hmm. Theater, or Venice Theater now, I'm sorry, with 3 lovely ladies, and that was well received. And so I said, okay. And so here I am doing Tina Howe's lovely, charming play about a somewhat dysfunctional family, I mean, what's new, with a different twist. Mm-hmm. And I'm directing that for the opening of their season. Their next show after that is Heroes, mm-hmm. and... Time After Time. Time Stands Still, sorry. I'm singing a song. I've done too many musicals. And my two friends, good friends, Dan Higgs, will be directing Heroes, and Don Walker will be directing Time Stands Still. And I have Don Walker doing my leading man in Painting Churches. Yes, he and his lovely wife, Jenny Aldridge, are the leads. They are the churches, Fanny and Gardner Church.
Ah.
And I have Olivia Williamson, who's a first-year student at the House of Rip.
Uh-huh.
And I think that's quite wonderful to have someone like that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the little
family. So it's a
family.
It's
just a three-person mm-hmm. show. That's the little family.
Okay, and it's running from June 27th to
yes.
July 14th.
Yes.
Which is not quite a month, but very nice. Okay, wonderful. All right, so the other question that I like to ask mm-hmm. is... Having spent a life, and you really have spent a life, if you figure from third grade.
Oh, well, yes. Right? There was lots of hiatus.
but it doesn't really matter, because it really sounds as though even when you were forced not to actively participate, you never lost your...
Desire,
yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Oh, during those 9 years, you know, I still took lessons.
Yeah, right.
And if there was a chance to sing at a wedding or bar mitzvah or a supermarket opening, you know, I was there.
I got it. All right. So having spent a life in really dedicated to this work, Do you want to think for a second what you would say about that, about spending a life?
There's nothing like it. Mm-hmm. It is very rewarding.
Yeah.
We have to keep arts alive in this country, in this mm-hmm. world. Mm-hmm. There's so much negativity. Mm-hmm. Even if you do nothing but community theater all your life, mm-hmm. that's very special. Community theater is very important in our life, in our culture. And they make you make wonderful friends. Mm-hmm. I love being around theater people. I prefer them to what I call normal people. And it just enriches your life and other people's.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, darn.
And that goes, if you're a painter, an artist, if you have that, or if you have an instrument to play, or a voice to sing, you're never lonely. You never are. You always have that. And it's good to share it, because people need it. Mm-hmm. I think it's a wonderful vocation.
Yeah, that's great. And a good place to stop. Thank you, Melissa.
Thank you.
When Melissa says, if you have a voice to sing, or you have, if you're a painter, or you're a dancer, you are never lonely, because you always have it. What I understand her to be saying is, you always have yourself. You have your real self. You have a connection to who you really are. And in fact, I believe she's right, that the more we are all that we really are, the more that we are living the life we were meant to live. And as Melissa says, even when she wasn't able to be actively participating in theater as an actor, as a singer, she was always studying. She was always singing at whatever opportunity she had, because she understood that this was who she was. And as long as she could keep that connection alive, the connection to her very self, she was okay. This is, of course, a part of why I encourage you all to find every aspect of yourself, to explore every aspect of yourself, so that you not only can live the life you were meant to live, but that you can feel that sense of connection to yourself and never be lonely. I'm running out of time for this show, so I'm going to read Sharon Leslie's review of Painting Churches, and then I'm going to close down the show. Don't let the title of the play that opens the Banyan Theatre 12th summer season lead you into thinking that Painting Churches has some sort of religious theme. This is a family drama of a dysfunctional nature. What else? In the vein of a Tennessee Williams play, only this one is set in Boston, not the Deep South, where sipping Dubonnet is what the cultivated classes do. Emotional violence is always more riveting on stage than the shoot-'em-up kind of violence one gets at the movies, especially when it's tinged with love. Ah, therein lies the rub, as Shakespeare would say. This semi-autobiographical story, written by award-winning playwright Tina Howe, has three great roles for actors. It's all about the dynamics of relationships between Gardner Church, his wife Fanny, and their grown daughter Margaret. This is a love triangle that happens sometimes between parents and a child. The triangle is the jealousy the wife feels for any attention taken from her when her husband pays attention and shows love to their daughter. That dynamic has its explosive and destructive moments as the two women vie for the attention of the man. It is all the more heartbreaking as both must come to terms with how the man they both love, in different ways of course, is failing due to age. As the play opens, the affluent churches are packing up the large family home in upper crust Boston to move to their smaller cottage. The play is beautifully colored by many quotes of poetry, since Gardner is a highly respected, award-winning poet laureate whose books are no longer selling. Don Walker is compelling as the aging Gardner, whose once brilliant brain is losing its grasp on reality. Gardner is moving into his second childhood with a speed that is deceptive unless you are living with him. Walker plays Gardner as a gentle soul whose love of language still allows him to quote memorized poetry with accuracy, but cannot finish a thought on paper as he struggles with short-term memory issues. Walker shows us that Gardner was quite the guy, capable of great charm when his wife entertains him with play-acting games. His is the performance to watch in its subtle depth. His wife Fanny is played by his wife of many years, Jenny Aldrich. This sort of casting adds to the performance a rare quality, a kind of easy body language of someone who has known one another for many years. Her role is perhaps the most difficult tightrope to walk in a performance. How to play an angry, aging, possessive woman in a way that garners empathy from the audience. Aldrich has a likable quality that endears her to audiences and her husband. Her claws come out when anyone, including her daughter, might capture a few moments away from her all-possessive love. Aldrich convincingly portrays the I don't care what anyone thinks, I'm going to do as I please attitude of a trust fund baby who has never had to earn a dollar or work a day in her life. Her anger at having to pack up the household belongings by herself is well done. Olivia Williamson, as their daughter Margaret, has the role that walks the definitive emotional journey of the night. As the portrait painter that the title refers to, Margaret arrives back at her childhood home, being packed up and sold with a variety of unresolved emotional issues. At first, she begins the usual struggle with her mother for her father's attention, with monologues about dramatic events of the past that cast her mother in a terrible light. But as these memories don't elicit the kind of sympathy she's seeking, she begins to open her eyes to what is happening to both of her parents. As she sets them down to actually sit for their portrait, she begins to use her artistic eye to see into their hearts. That is, she begins to quit acting like a child and see them with adult eyes. Williamson is touching in those deeply emotional moments. When both parents finally give their approval of the portrait she's created of them, she deliciously underplays the moment. The show is beautifully staged by director Melissa Kenworthy, with a naturalness that has an organic quality. The actors inhabit the space as if it has been their home for many years. She successfully shows that being cultured does not keep any of these characters from having human flaws. The home, that is the set by Chris McVigor, is attractive and well laid out in soft aristocratic colors and proportions. The lighting by Joseph Osrees is artistic and sets a genteel mood. The classical music segues add to the cultivated sensitivities of the characters. This Mannion production of Painting Churches is one to see. Okay, that's it for me for today. So as always, I hope you got something that you can use from this show. Something that interested you, something that you didn't know, something that titillated you, something that made you want to come and see Painting Churches, something that will bring you back. Because I will be here next week, same time, same station. And as always, I sure hope you will be too.
You see, I'm getting older. My hair is turning gray. Oh, you see my face and figure. I've both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring. I won't slip out of sight, no. I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. You see that I have had my shot. My time has come and gone. Oh, won't I please get off the stage? Let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated. Oh, fight, no, I will not go gentle into that good night. won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang, rising from the ashes every chance I get. I may be running out of time, but it ain't over yet. 'Cause me and Sister Phoenix, we won't give up the flight, no, no. We will not go gentle into the